Hello, and welcome to another episode of The First 10 Pages. Yes, we're doing the Blues Brothers this time around. I think this will be a lot of fun. Blues Brothers is a classic comedy that almost everybody loves. So let's talk about what the Blues Brothers is, was, should have been, could have been. A little bit about that. Not all of that. Some of that. The Blues Brothers started out as a sketch on NBC's Saturday Night Live program. If somehow you don't know what Saturday Night Live is, it is a weekly comedy sketch program taped live. So what you see on TV is what's actually happening in the studio at that moment. Amazing. Dan Aykroyd and John Belushi played the Blues Brothers. This came about because of Dan Aykroyd's love for blues music, and he got John Belushi into it. So they decided to do a sketch, and then the sketch became a phenomenon. Then they opened for Steve Martin, who was already a phenomenon, and they got the director, the guy who directed Animal House, which was also a phenomenon. Phenomenon. Doot, 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 doot. Phenomenon. Doot, 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 doot. Phenomenon. Doot, 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 doot. Anywho, and then they made a movie. The Blues Brothers' budget was supposed to be around $17 million, but it ballooned due to, if I recall what I read, and I'm not looking at it anymore because I did my research and I'm tired, but what I think I read was that all them destroyed cars and all those live shots on Chicago streets and John Belushi disappearing every now and again caused production delays and problems, and the budget just kept ballooning and the studio kept forking over money. And they were probably nervous and not happy with doing so. But then, you know, the movie went on to make like $57 million domestically and I think another $50 million or so internationally, although those numbers I couldn't quite confirm. Still, that's pretty good, especially for 1980. So yeah, that was a big ol' hit. The cast of the Blues Brothers is pretty insane. Not only do we have John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd, but our guest musicians include, in alphabetical order, James Brown, Cab Calloway, Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, and John Lee Hooker. We also get some interesting cameos by the likes of Carrie Fisher and Twiggy, Steve Lawrence, Frank Oz, and Steven Spielberg. John Landis is in there somewhere too, in the mall scene. Big deal mall chase scene. If you care, by the way, that mall closed some years earlier. All the cars in the parking lot were from a car dealership and were brand new, so they couldn't crash into any of those cars because that means they would have had to pay for them rather than just rent them for the night. But they still had to film that high-speed sequence around them. But if you look closely, there are a number of shots that are indeed done on rear projection on a stage, which is common for most films. I've always wondered if JCPenney and Toys R Us paid for their appearances in the movie. Product placement was not something that was unusual in 1980. As a matter of fact, around the same time, Superman 2 famously got into some hot water because it featured prominently advertisements for Marlboro cigarettes. Yes, a Superman movie for the whole family, where you can smoke. To be fair, this was at a time period where there were smoking and non-smoking sections in movie theaters. Because, you know, if you're sitting in the non-smoking section in row 14, but the smoking section ends in row 12, the people in row 14 will be fine. It's no big deal. I also have to mention Henry Gibson, who's absolutely terrific as the head Nazi, and John Candy as Mercer. The original script for the Blues Brothers is said to be a more than 300-page opus written by Dan Aykroyd, who did not know how to write a screenplay, so he decided to put every idea he had into a script. The thing that's amazing about this that we have to keep in mind, 1980, he probably did not do that on some kind of early version of an Apple II computer. He probably did that all on a typewriter. He typed out 320 or 40 something pages. Again, I don't have it in front of me. I know I should, but I'm so tired of searching the Blues Brothers. So I don't have it in front of me. So I'm doing a lot of approximating. Deal with it. So yeah, it was 300 something pages of script. Apparently what took up 300 something pages of script was he felt it was necessary to go into a lot of the background of the boys, the Blues Brothers themselves, Joliet Jake, played by Belushi, and Elwood Blues, played by Dan Aykroyd. And he also went into the backgrounds of every single band member who they go on a quest to get back into their band to play this one important show, which is the plot of the movie. And then he handed all that over to John Landis, and was like, here, deal with this. Here, deal with this. That was probably more how it went. And John Landis went, fine. And he did. And we ended up with a pretty spectacular film filled with cameos as the two main characters are on a quest to get from one place to another to become big successes and make a lot of money, but for a good reason. It's not just about the money. It's because they're making money for an orphanage. They're going to make millions of kids happy this way. And it's the same exact plot as the Muppet movie. It's even the same script as the Muppet movie. It's the same movie. The Muppet movie and the Blues Brothers are the same. And they're both terrific. One has a lot of cuss words and says a lot of terrible things, and there's a big, beefy, fuzzy guy who is unpredictable, and the other one is the Blues Brothers. Okay, so I'm stealing some jokes from Craig Ferguson, all right? If you don't know Craig Ferguson, Google his Late Late Show. It was very good. So we're going to be looking at the first 10 pages of the script as rewritten by John Landis. We're not going to be looking at the 300-plus page tome by Dan Aykroyd, which I did not find, but I'm sure if I put in another 3 or 4 or 5 days of searching, I will find it. And that was the thing. It took me several days to find an actual Blues Brothers script. Most of what's online is listed as an actual Blues Brothers script, but for anyone who's seen a screenplay, you can tell right away, that ain't it. It doesn't read like a script, it doesn't look like a script, it's not a script. It's missing a lot of the action, it's missing a correct cover page. There is a cover page, but it's not. It's 100% not a real cover page. I spotted that right off and I thought, okay, there's gotta be a real Blues Brothers script around here somewhere. And eventually I found one. I don't even remember where I found it. I was searching for so many hours for so many days until I finally found one. But here we go. I'm going to read the first 10 pages as I normally do. I will give you guys a timestamp to skip to. If you stick around, you will hear me trying my best to do a Chicagoan accent. Hopefully I'll get this right. I feel like I will because
I'm on a mission from God.
Also, I feel like the accent gets better as it goes. Give it a chance. Alrighty. Go to 19 minutes, 25 seconds to skip the script read. At the top left, it reads number 00601. I don't know if this is a Writers Guild Association registry number or what. Maybe it's a studio number of some kind. I don't know. Under that, it says June 6, 1979. On the right side, it reads Executive Producer Bernie Brillstein, Producer Robert K. Weiss. The Blues Brothers by Dan Aykroyd and John Landis.
Fade in. Joliet Prison. Dawn. Wide establishing shot. As the sun begins to rise, an ancient sandstone fortress. The morning sun lends a bright red hue to the walls and the parapets. A dog barks OS. A black 1974 Plymouth Fury four-door sedan pulls up and parks. The driver cuts the motor. It dies with a rumble. The motor and metal cool down with a series of pings. The driver hunches down in the front seat. Cut to Joliet cell block. Four stories of tears. The sound of many men snoring. Two guards enter through electric doors and walk down the gangway on one of the tiers. They stop in front of a cell. Cut to interior. Cell. Guards. Point of view. A black inmate in jockey shorts and t-shirt is lying on his back, smoking a cigarette on the bottom bunk. A white man in a prison blue shirt and jeans sleeps on his side on the top bunk facing the wall. Guard number one.
He slept in his clothes.
Guard number two.
Yeah, a lot of them do that the night before.
Guard number one.
Deputy Warden told me to get this one out of the block early. He wants to get it over with fast.
Okay, let's do it.
Psst. Hey, psst. Wake up. Come on, it's time.
Guard number one pokes his nightstick through the bars, nudging the man in the top bunk in the ribs. He sits up wearily. We are unable to see his face.
Let's go, Jake. It's time.
The black prisoner sits up and offers his cigarette to Jake. Jake takes a long drag. As guard number one unlocks the cell door, Jake hands the cigarette back to the black prisoner.
So long, Jake.
Jake and the black prisoner exchange a soul handshake. Interior, gallery, at cell, day. Both guards step back into the gangway and stand shoulder to shoulder, obscuring the prisoner who turns and walks out of the cell. Guard number one slides the cell door closed. Exterior, gangway. They escort the prisoner down to the end of the gangway, away from the camera. The electric door slides open. They exit. Cut to interior. Cell. The black prisoner watches Jake and the guards as they disappear down the hallway. Black prisoner.
Sleep tight, Jake.
Interior. Prison. Guards hustle the prisoner through a series of electric doors, a set of caged-in stairs, past a guard station, down a hall to the thick door with a small round wire mesh porthole. The guard presses a button. Guard number one.
Will? This is it.
A loud buzzer sounds as the door latch clicks open. The guard and the prisoner enter the room. Interior, property room. It is divided by a counter. Behind the counter is a wall of small cubicle shelves like the stockroom of a shoe store. There are numbers over each shelf. A correctional officer emerges from behind the shelves. He walks to the counter. Guard number two, reading off a clipboard.
747-4505B.
Officer.
What wing?
Guard number two.
Maximum wing, block 9.
Standard release?
Parole, 3 out of 5, good behavior.
Okay, give me a minute.
The officer behind the counter disappears into a row of shelves. The guards move the prisoner tight to the counter. Cut to close-up. Counter. Prisoner's torso. His belly is pressed up to the counter. His hands are drumming a clear rhythmic beat on the countertop. The officer returns and enters frame, placing 2 boxes on the counter. He opens them, dispensing various articles.
1 unused prophylactic. 1 soiled. 1 man's hair comb. 1 Timex digital watch. Broken. 2 gold-plated finger rings. 1 black suit jacket. 1 pair black suit pants. 1 yellow, white arrow shirt. 1 black necktie. 1 pair sunglasses. $23.07. Sign the receipt, please.
The prisoner signs with an X.
I don't want to see you again, Jake.
Cut to exterior. Joliet. Prison gate. Day. The huge electric gates slide open with blinding light coming from within, revealing the silhouette of the man, Joliet Jake, in his suit, sunglasses, and hat. He adjusts his tie. Cut to exterior, prison, Jake's POV, the black CPR. A man gets out. He wears identical sunglasses, suit, and hat. He is taller, greasy-looking. He is Jake's brother, Elwood. Exterior, prison, high-wide shot. The brothers walk toward each other solemnly until they stand face to face. The huge electro gate slams shut with a clang. Cut to extreme close-up, Jake, as music comes in hard. The first title is supered, John Belushi. Cut to extreme close-up, Elwood. Second title is supered, Dan Aykroyd. Cut to exterior, prison, wide shot, as the brothers embrace, super title,
The Blues Brothers.
Exterior, prison, Jake and Elwood, without a word, get in the car. Elwood in the driver's seat. Exterior, side street. The car drives along the street, running parallel to the prison walls, turns down a street behind the prison and parks a few buildings in. Exterior, whorehouse. Behind prison, the car parks in front of a little brick bungalow. Jake and Elwood get out of the car and walk up to the front door of the house. Jake knocks intensely. The door is open. They are admitted. Interior whorehouse, vestibule day. Bright red shag carpeting covers the hall and a set of stairs. The wallpaper is red and gold embossed velveteen. Cecile, a good-looking black woman in her 40s, ushers the brothers into the hall and closes the door. She is built, an ex-stripper, wearing a double-knit pantsuit and high red beehive wig. Cecile.
Hi, are you from the prison?
Jake.
Yeah, I'm Joliet Jake. This is my brother, Elwood.
When did you get out, honey?
10 minutes ago.
Well, I'm Cecile. Come on in. I'm sure you're going to enjoy my new girls.
She shows them into the room off the hall. Cut to interior girls' lounge. The room is furnished in bright orange shag carpeting. A couple of loud plaid convertible couches, chrome coffee table, a hot plate and toaster oven, a large poster version of sexual positions of the Zodiac. There is a big 21-inch color TV console with a video game program. There are 3 women in the room. Canny, a slight blonde, white, waif-like creature, no more than 20, a runaway. She is playing the video game with Penny, a young, well-rounded black lady. Another woman, Streak, watches them play. She is a mature, statuesque woman of 30 who wears a short-cropped black haircut with a pink streak down one side of it. All of these women are clothed in light house coats.
Yeah, man, Dan Aykroyd definitely wrote all that.
Cecile.
Girls, I'd like to introduce, Mr. Joliet Jake and his brother...
Elwood.
Now, who wants to take Jake upstairs?
I'll take him.
Not you, honey. Streak.
The girl with the streak opens the door to the hall and motions for Jake to go upstairs. Jake pauses, looks at her, raises his eyebrow above his shades, turns, and goes into the hall. She follows him, closing the door.
Cecile. Now, Elwood, what can we do for you?
How about a cup of tea?
A cup of tea? Why, sure. Penny, put on the kettle. Connie, take care of Elwood.
Penny gets up from the couch and puts the kettle on the hot plate. Elwood sits next to the little blonde, Elwood and Connie.
So, what's on the TV?
Just some games, like you can put different games on.
You ever watch Highway Patrol with Broderick Crawford? Used to be my favorite show.
No, like, this is cable TV. They don't got that show on cable. Like, with cable, you get movies and these games. You wanna play?
Sure, Connie gets up to program a video game.
Wide shot, room.
The kettle whistles. The door opens and Jake walks in. He knots his tie.
Okay, Elwood, let's go.
But your tea is ready.
It's okay, we have to go. Jake and Cecile is $23.07.
Bye now. Come again.
Jake and Elwood exit. Cut to interior, Bluesmobile, moving, Calumet City, day. Jake puts a cigarette in his mouth. He punches the car's lighter.
What's this?
What?
This car. This stupid car. Our Cadillac.
The lighter doesn't work. Jake tosses it to the floor.
The caddy. Where's the caddy?
The what?
The Cadillac. We used to have the Bluesmobile.
I traded it.
You traded it? You traded the Bluesmobile for this?
No. For a microphone.
A microphone?
Considers a moment.
Okay, I can see that. But what the hell is this?
It's a bargain. I picked it up at the Mount Prospect City Police auction last spring. It's an old Mount Prospect police car.
Thanks a lot, pal. The day I get out of prison and my own brother picks me up in a police car.
You don't like it?
No, I don't like it.
Exterior Bluesmobile as it pulls up and stops behind a line of traffic waiting behind a barrier at a split swing bridge. Cut to Elwood. He boots the accelerator. Cut to interior Bluesmobile. Moving. Swing bridge. Day. Extreme close-up. Speedometer. Numbers from 0 to 140. Centered on the words MPH certified calibration. The needle jumps from 30 to 65. Pan to Elwood. Exterior Bluesmobile. It swerves around the waiting traffic, around the barrier, and up onto the elevating swing bridge. Interior Bluesmobile. POV through windshield. The car is traveling vertically up. I'm starting to sound more like Maxwell Smart, Agent 86. Exterior, swing bridge, wide shot. The barge passes through the bridge. The car jumps the canal, landing safely on the far section of the swing bridge. Interior, Bluesmobile, moving. Day, Elwood is proudly straightening his tie.
Jake, car's got a lot of pickup.
Elwood, it's got cup motor, a 440 cubic inch plant, cup springs, cup shocks, cup suspension, con tires. It was a model made before catalytic converter, so it runs on regular gas. What do you say? Is it the new Bluesmobile or what?
Fix the cigarette lighter.
Cut to exterior, orphanage, in Calumet City, day. The Bluesmobile pulls up and parks in front of a narrow three-story red brick building wedged in between two huge soiled factories. The building is one-third the size of the two buildings beside it, with a small, fat stone cross in its roof and a slab of stone below on which a legend is carved. Cut to close-up. Small building. A block with chiseled letters. St. Helen of the Blessed Shroud Orphanage, 1923. Dwarfing the little orphanage on either side are factories with expanses of small, gritty windows. Large signs on each top story. On the left, Illinois Drag Line Company. On the right, Chicago Pressed Heads Metal Milling. Interior, Bluesmobile, parked at orphanage, day.
Where are we?
You promised you'd visit the penguin the day you got out.
Yeah, so I lied to her.
You can't lie to a nun. We gotta go in and visit the penguin. Cut to 33-39, omitted, 40, scene. Those are scene numbers. Interior, orphanage, dormitory, day. A long chamber with rows of little
iron-framed cots.
A sink, table, and chair next to each one. The windows have wire mesh grating over them. Jake and Elwood enter and walk through the room. Elwood stops at one of the cots.
Look at our old beds. Yeah, with chairs. Boy, these kids really got it plush.
Wide angle, dormitory. Jake and Elwood continue through the rows of beds to a small door in one corner of the room. Jake opens it. Page 11. And we're all done.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about what we got there. It was a little interesting.
It was a little awkward.
It was a little uncomfortable.
The stuff with the quote-unquote black prisoner seemed to be establishing Jake's street cred and his black culture cred. Neither of those are needed. We get that stuff later on. Having that prisoner and seeing the
guards roust him out of his bed, completely unnecessary. It also slows down the opening. We want to see John Belushi, especially back then. You got to remember, we're here to see John and Dan do their Blues Brothers thing. It opens more or less the way the film opens, on the cell block and Jake being brought out. The boys say hello to each other and off they go to a whorehouse, which logically does make sense. But also, no, let's not do that. I'm very glad they got rid of that. I guess what they were trying to do is show that Elwood's a good guy. And there was a little gag about how quickly Jake finishes, you know, because he's out fixing his tie before the tea kettle whistles, in case he didn't catch it. But it was just awkward. There are a lot of old SNL sketches by Aykroyd that are about women and dating. Not a lot, but a few. They come off as creepy as that scene did. I don't think they're purposely creepy. I don't think he's a creepy guy. I just am assuming that, you know, based on the fact that he's into the supernatural and sci-fi stuff and, you know, kind of a comedy nerd, which was great for his career, and into lots of weird, unusual things, he was probably a nerdy guy and didn't have a lot of interaction with girls in his preteen and teen years, and maybe was a little awkward about all of that dating and girl stuff. And as such, he would write sequences like the one we see in the movie, where he's hanging out with a little girl at a brothel, you know, featuring girls that are talking like they're much too young to be there and saying that she's a runaway. Oh, none of that. This movie would have been long forgotten, I think, if it opened with all of that. But, you know, at the end of the day, Dan Aykroyd married Donna Dixon. Sunny, 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 sunny. Anywho, they then go to the orphanage. That is the same. And cutting out all the stuff in between, it allows us to get to the meat of what the movie's going to be about. And Jake and Elwood to sit with Cab Calloway for a little bit, and we get a little bit of what Jake and Elwood are about and how they became the Blues Brothers, how they learned to love blues and why they are who they are and how they act the way they act. All that stuff is explained very smoothly, very nicely. One of the other differences I didn't get to is there's more about Jake and Elwood seeking redemption because they committed crimes. Jake held up a gas station. That's apparently how he went to prison. Elwood was in the car. That's in the script, and it's on pages that I didn't get to because they were beyond the first 10. The arc of Jake being resistant to improving himself and becoming a better man and earning the money that the sister needs fairly, all of that is hit a little bit harder in this script. Some of that would have done well in the movie, but we get enough of it. Some of the other things that we get, there is no mention in the script of their names being tattooed on their hands. That, as it turned out, was a great visual way to tell us who's who. Elwood's speech about the new Bluesmobile differs slightly from what's on the page, and I'm guessing that was just in order to tighten it a little bit. The speech that I read isn't quite as funny as the one that's done in the actual film, so I'm thinking that they probably had it that way, and then either Danny or Landis realized, feels like you're rambling, can we tighten it up a little bit? Without the stuff from the brothel, the stuff with the quote-unquote black prisoner, without those things, the movie gives us a much quicker pace and a much lighter tone at the start. The movie is an R-rated film, but a lighthearted R-rated film. So to focus on the locations of prison and a whorehouse, to quote the script, it seems like the wrong way to go. In some of my research between reading the script and just now, I did see that there is a 148-minute length version for the Collector's Edition DVD. The running time of the final version was 133 minutes. I don't know what's in those missing minutes. I haven't seen it. I have a feeling it probably slows down the pacing. Sometimes studios are right about stuff like that. While I'm all for directors having final cut and believe that they should, they also need someone whispering in their ear, "Dude, it's a little self-indulgent." John Landis stated in a Blues Brothers documentary that he had cut some stuff where Dan Aykroyd had an explanation about parking the car amid some, I don't know, generators or large electric coils or something like that that's supposed to sort of supercharge the Bluesmobile, and that's why it can do backflips or something. And Landis joked, "Well, if you're going to explain that to everybody who sees the movie in every theater across the nation, I'll keep it in." And then he goes on to say in this documentary that you don't need to explain everything. It's just you put it in the movie and it's there and the audience will understand it. Except he's sort of minimizing his own work, because Landis does expertly set up the idea that there is magic in this world and that they are on a mission from God. Very early on, when the Blues Brothers get into the orphanage, the door in the orphanage closes behind them magically. The penguin knows that. I'm going to keep calling her that because it's fun. The penguin knows they're on the other side of the door before they knock. After she tells them that the orphanage needs money and they better go out and help her, she floats away when they leave. And then they go to the church, and the heavenly light hits Jake, and only Jake sees it. Magic, God, it's all in there. And it's important for the story for it to be in there. Especially considering that everything that goes well for them, as far as those two guys are concerned, Jake and Elwood, because they're on a mission from God. If they weren't, if they were just doing selfish acts, then they wouldn't have the confidence and assurance that they're going to achieve their goal. But they do, because they're on a mission from God. So why wouldn't they? Let's talk briefly about the cameos of Twiggy and Carrie Fisher. Those two storylines. Twiggy, in case you don't know, she was a big deal model in the 60s in the UK. I don't really know how she ended up in this movie. And I don't really know why Elwood needed a brief, unremarkable, unimportant romantic storyline. That didn't go anywhere. But the same can be said about the Carrie Fisher-Jake storyline. The only reason Carrie Fisher's character seems to be there is to offer them obstacles along the way. It slows them down several times. It helps them get away. She's an obstacle for the cops when she destroys Elwood's home and they leave and everybody's fine. She shows up later as just a reminder that she's there. And then she shows up at the end to add just a little bit of tension for whether Jake and Elwood will get away from the cops, as the cops are looking for them when they sneak out of the theater in the climax, at the beginning of the climax of the film. There's really no other purpose for her to be there except to say that it's Carrie Fisher from the Star Wars movie that we all know. So it's important to have someone like that there. That's, you know, Steve Lawrence was a big deal. That's why he was there. Paul Rubens was he wasn't a big deal, but he is in the movie, briefly. Let's talk a little about Charles Napier, the lead singer of the Good Old Boys band that shows up when the Blues Brothers are finished playing at that country western bar. They show up in the trailer, and he's the guy that steps out as sort of the guy in charge. He nails it. He's great in every scene in this movie. He's only got a few lines at the end of the day, but man, he's good. And he was all over the place when I was a kid. That guy was in everything. Married to the Mob, Silence of the Lambs, Manchurian Candidate, Star Trek,
Starsky and Hutch, Kojak, Beretta, Rockford Files, Streets of San Francisco, Austin Powers, Rambo, First Blood Part 2, National Lampoon's
Loaded Weapon.
Knight Rider, Simon & Simon, Chips, Dallas, The A-Team, Night Court, Murder, She Wrote, L.A. Law.
The Cable Guy.
Incredible Hulk, BJ and the Bear, that's probably where I knew him from originally. The Private Benjamin TV series, Dukes of Hazzard TV series.
He worked almost to the end of his life. He passed away in 2011, and his last two credits are in 2009.
The Golden Palace, Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Superman the Animated Series. He did a voice for the Jumanji cartoon. Walker, Texas Ranger, Roswell, The Practice.
This dude was in everything. Now, I've seen some complaints about the movie online. Of course, not everybody loves it. One of the biggest complaints is the pacing sometimes is slow. I'll give you that. It does have 70s pacing. It was made in the 70s. But I feel like the scenes that are a little bit long, they're long because we're getting character moments or some funny gags. Maybe some of the comedy doesn't play as well on TV as it did in the theater. Maybe it doesn't play as well decades later as it did. Those are two reasons that people today might think some of the pacing is a little bit slow. Other complaints that I personally have are that there's a couple of plot things that they never really do wrap up. It would have been nice if we could see a final moment with the Penguin. You know, maybe waving the cash around, fanning herself and dancing as they play the final song for the closing credits. Or maybe she's dancing with Cab Calloway. Just something to show us that she's proud for them getting the money for her legally. It would have been nice to see Matt Guitar Murphy's wife, Aretha Franklin, in an insert shot in the back of the Palace Hotel ballroom, seeing that her husband went out and did a good thing for good reason. Maybe she's shaking hands with the Penguin because they're doing good things together. It just would have been nice. Just a quick shot. Two other little notes that I noticed this time around. One is, well, something I've always noticed that I always giggled is when we meet Matt Guitar Murphy at the Soul Food Diner where Aretha Franklin is. He's cooking in the back and she tells him that there are two white guys out there and their orders are crazy. One just wants dry white toast and the other one wants four fried chickens. When she says the dried white toast, he puts his hand to his chin like he's thinking or excited or whatever it was that John Landis told him that a hand to the chin would mean. I don't know how he acted it before he was directed to put his hand to his chin, but you could see it's like this very over-rehearsed moment of hand to chin, and then go, Elwood. The other thing that stood out to me this time is when the Nazis are on the bridge, just before the Blues Brothers knock them off of it, you know, all the crowd is screaming at the Nazis and telling them to get the hell out of their town and all those things, and a couple of things we hear are, Go back to where you came from and get out of our home. Things have changed since this decade, but no, that's exactly what should be screamed at Nazis. That's exactly on point. So, do the first 10 minutes of the Blues Brothers script represent the rest of the movie? Based on what I've seen of the script, I would say absolutely yes. It is a little bit darker. The script itself gives a little more breathing room between the musical numbers. It's not quite as fast-paced of a musical, and it is an action comedy musical, as what we got on screen. And what we got on screen reflects that version a lot better. Both are great. Both are smart and fun and funny. And I think that's the first time that's happened here, where I thought both versions completely reflect what we got from that point on.
And that would take us to the end of the show.
Thanks once again for joining me. And please remember, people, that no matter who you are and what you do to live, thrive, and survive, there are still some things that make us all the same. You, me, them, everybody.
Everybody. Everybody.
See you at the table read.
If you want to continue this conversation and follow me on the socials, I love talking movies, TV, and comic books at The Reality Comics on Blue Sky, which is like Twitter but not, and Instagram. That's both at The Reality Comics. Thank you so much for listening. See you at the table read. The first 10 pages is written, hosted, and edited by Keith Planet. Music by Edison Carter. Any corrections, questions, or comments, please reach out via social media on Blue Sky or Instagram at The Reality Comics. The first 10 pages, copyright 2026.
You're gonna look pretty funny trying to eat corn on the cob with no teeth. Stein.